It's Wednesday, March 20th, 2024, from Peachfish Productions. It's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. This is Crime Week, and today we have two different and very disparate conversations. First, when we talk about crime in the United States, murder is always something I talk about, and it's the worst crime, and it's a signature crime, and a lot of criminologists study murder because it tells us where crime is going, and also it tends to get reported. So with some crimes, there's a lot of folk information about it, or anecdotal information, or information that you might see on social media or the evening news. But is that really indicative of if those particular types of crime are up? A big category of crime that often does not track the statistics as much as it tracks what people feel about the statistics is shoplifting. So I wanted to do a segment where I talked to Adam Gelb, who's the CEO of the Council on Criminal Justice. And also on the show, I'm going to be joined by Ben Austin, who is the author of Correction, Parole, Prison, and the Possibility of Change. This is why I called it Disparate Interviews. Ben, along with Johnny Veal, who is a formerly incarcerated individual who is one of the main subjects of Ben's book, they'll join me to talk about the prison system, the parole system, the societal costs, and in Johnny's case, the costs that he was made to bear. Ben Austin, Johnny Veal on the show, but first, Adam Gelb. A lot of times when you hear about VPNs, I find that they just assume you know what they are, or even if you have an understanding, oh, they're a virtual private network, you might not know the acronym, but in general, don't they mask what you do online? Why do I need that? People don't explain it correctly, and it was explained to me when I got into the beneficial aspects of Surfshark. So a VPN does mask what you do online, and that's really important for some people who, might be trying to be a dissident in an oppressive regime. It's also just important in terms of general hygiene for why do you have to let every advertiser and everyone else know where you were and, you know, follow your tracks. But I find it's also very practical. Like I said, it's a mask. And so a mask does hide identity, but a mask, a well-fitted N95 mask also might protect you, which is what a VPN does too. Practically, however, in my life, there are many websites that when I'm traveling, I can access. I have and pay for access to them. Then I find myself in as far-flung a place as Canada. Sometimes, as an American, a foreign version of, say, Netflix would come in handy. I'd like to watch some of those shows, and I'm not just talking about Czechoslovak soap operas. I'm talking about how the excellent movies move in and out of the different Netflix in different localities. With a really good VPN like Surfshark, you could access all of them. And another big one for me is there is a major broadcaster in Britain. It is a broadcasting company there, but they don't let me hear all the stuff that someone there can hear. With a VPN, I could listen to that as if I were there. There are so many practical uses, plus the traditional use of why let them know exactly what you're doing. Your surfing is for you. A VPN allows you to surf what you want to surf, where you want to surf, without interference from, let's say, repressive governments or the Czech Netflix regime. Get Surfshark VPN at surfshark.deals/gist. What are those deals? Well, enter promo code GIST for 3 extra months for free. You heard me right. 3 extra months for free. That's surfshark.deals/gist. This episode is brought to you by the Jordan Harbinger Show. You've heard me talk about the Jordan Harbinger Show because it's one of my favorites. He does in-depth interviews with some of the world's most fascinating minds. I can name a few: Barbara Boxer, Anderson Cooper, Michael McFaul, the Ukraine or Russia ambassador talking about Ukraine. One I recently listened to was Stanley McChrystal, the general, the former general, and he told an interesting story about revering Robert E. Lee. But then, after having a portrait of him for 40 years, he's a 63-year-old man, throwing it in the trash. Because his wife says, you know, what that picture and that man means to you, it doesn't mean to other people, and you have to understand that. And then in the interview, they got around to the point where McChrystal talked about that interview in Rolling Stone magazine that pretty much ended his career, where got to the desk of Barack Obama and it had McChrystal saying unflattering things about the war effort and just how he talked to his wife and how they decided not to be bitter and not to wallow in it. He could have taken some shots at the process, the reporter, or the president at that point, but he didn't. It was just an overall good interview. It was facilitated by Jordan's excellent interview style. Whether Jordan is conducting an interview or giving advice to a listener, you will find something useful that can apply to your own life in every single episode of The Jordan Harbinger Show. That could mean learning how to ask for advice the right way or discovering a little mindset tweak that changes how you see the world. Search for The Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R, like the first three letters in hard, B-I-N-G-E, as in how you'll want to catch up on all the episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Shoplifting, we have heard and we have felt, has become a scourge in America, but maybe, you know, you can question all the parts of that sentence. Scourge, become. The question is shoplifting on the rise? Is the type of shoplifting different from what we've always experienced? What are the facts? What can we do about it? I'm joined by Adam Gelb. He's president and CEO of the Council on Criminal Justice, a member of their board of directors. He has an interesting background with working in criminal and juvenile justice reform with the Pew Charitable Trusts and as a longtime reporter on criminal justice. Adam, welcome to The Gist.
Thanks, Mike. It's great to be with you.
So we'll start with the top line numbers or question. Compared to the pre-pandemic years, is shoplifting up in America?
So you're asking the right questions. It's not just one question because, and I think this is something that is just all about the volume. And if we focus just on the number of incidents reported to police, we're going to get a very different picture of what's happening and not happening. So, but to start with that, and just the raw number of what shoplifting incidents are actually reported to the police, we've seen a significant drop during the first years of the pandemic, and then a rebound back in the last year or so to pre-pandemic levels. So it went down when stores closed and couldn't get in to steal stuff.
Yeah.
Right? The pandemic in so many ways is giving us a master class in criminology, right? It takes motive, means, and opportunity to commit a crime. And all three of those things changed significantly during the pandemic with the disruptions. But opportunity may have changed the most. And so there were less burglary in people's homes. People were home. It was harder to steal. The risks were greater to steal and breaking into someone's home. And of course, businesses were closed. So we saw a fairly steep drop at the beginning of the pandemic. And now that things are reopening, we're seeing a number of shoplifting incidents as reported to police rise.
Okay. So However, I just want to interrupt and say that there's a bad sort of reporting that could go on, an alarmist reporting that did go on. And you know this as a, you know, decades-long journalist. The year after things open back up, you can compare year-on-year numbers and have that extremely scary 80% rise. So we want to acknowledge that. And maybe that was not inaccurately reported, but not reported in proper context. But what you're saying is now, late 2023, or wherever we have the best numbers from, compare it to 2019, the incidents are on the rise.
You're exactly right. It depends what time period you look at. The answer to this question, if you look back a year, it's up. If you look back 5 years, it's about the same place that it was. Beyond the raw number of incidents that are reported to police, it's critical to understand that a lot of these things are not reported to the police, and they're not reported for a whole bunch of reasons on the retailer side and on the police side. We think, and the best estimates are that maybe somewhere around 20% of incidents are reported to police. And that's going to vary widely from retailer to retailer. Different stores have different policies for what they want to get involved with and they want to get the police involved with. And then on the police side, there are different messages that are being sent to retailers about whether or not the police and eventually the prosecutors want these kinds of cases. So it's a very muddy picture at best.
Yeah, I want to, though, ask you about the 20% or I don't know how you would actually know how much is not reported. You could do internal surveys of your members, but if it's not reported, it's not reported. But has that changed? So if there's always been a baked in around 20%, it is fair to compare year to year numbers.
Yeah, we don't have any good idea. And when I say we, I mean really nobody does, perhaps except for the retailers who are not sharing that information publicly, whether or not that reporting rate has changed over time. It makes sense that it's possible that it has changed over time and has gone down on account of some changing laws that have happened over the past 10 to 15 years that increased the felony theft threshold, right? It makes some logical sense that if the penalties for stealing something from a store are reduced, that some people along the way, whether it's a store employee, whether it's a store management, whether it's the corporate office on that side, or whether it's the police or prosecutors, are going to be less interested in infilling with that offense if it's just not going to result in what they would view as appropriate penalties.
You could take whatever start date to compare it to, but has the increase in the incidents and the increase in the amount that is shoplifted, I guess, norming for inflation, which does kick in a significant way in the last few years, is it up very much, or there are going to be fluctuations and recently we're in a bit of an upswing?
So here's where I want to pivot away from the total volume, because it is fairly uncertain. I think it's obviously legitimate to look at police reports. That's what we've been doing the past couple of years, trying to shed what light is available publicly on this. So super important. I don't think that's what's driving public opinion about this and the media coverage, right? People are not really sitting around looking at and caring about whether something is up 10% or down 10%, up 20% or down 20%. This is much more about the nature than the number. And, you know, unfortunately, what we've seen is a number of incidents where large groups of people are going into stores, ransacking them and knocking people over and running out with a whole bunch of stuff or filling up duffel bags. And even if those incidents are rare, which they seem to be extremely rare, and which our data has found they are extremely rare and make up a very tiny percentage of overall shoplifting incidents, they just land with people much differently. And they suggest to people that there is a culture of lawlessness, and that that these kind of brazen and acts that are just things that society shouldn't see at all, whether they're rare or not. And so that's, I think, what's driving the concern and what's really bothering people, a low tolerance for that kind of incident, not necessarily a misperception of how rampant it is.
I want you to address a claim which I think has mostly basis in fact, but I don't know if it's being presented in the way that's the most accurate and helpful to the public. So there was a claim about a $45 billion increase in organized retail theft. And in the Los Angeles Times, their columnist Michael Hiltzik wrote a column titled "How the Retail Lobby Sold a $45 Billion Whopper About Organized Shoplifting." And he writes, "If you're making a list of big news stories of 2023, here's one you might want to check twice. The surge in organized retail crime or gang shoplifting. There has been a recent development on the topic which demands your attention. Put simply, the retail lobby has admitted that its most eye-catching and widely publicized statistic about it is a lie. The statistic, published in April by the National Retail Federation, was that organized retail crime, including the videotaped flash mob smash-and-grab events aired in frequent rotation on the cable and evening news shows, came to more than $45 billion a year. The Federation acknowledged that its own estimate was a fabrication, and it updated its report to remove the estimate, but the damage had been done." What did he get right and what did he get wrong about that statistic and your update to it?
They did a bad analysis and they discovered it and they corrected it. It's hard to know kind of how much damage in terms of perception was done in the meantime. And there are legislatures across the country that have ramped up organized retail theft budgets, created task forces, and created new laws and penalties against organized theft. And some of that may have, in fact, been driven by that bad information and the perception that was created before they corrected it. At the same time, it's hard not to applaud them for owning up to that mistake and coming out and saying it actually is nowhere near half. This was a flawed analysis, and to correct it and get it back to where at least they say it is, which is down more than the single digit percents.
Well, what he was saying, what Hiltzik was arguing with, the damage being done is that federal and state level officials pushed legislation aimed at fighting the onslaught of thieves. Is that, in your estimation, is that a misuse of resources?
It can be. It's very hard to know what percentage of overall theft and shoplifting is actually organized retail theft and would be addressed by these laws. We just don't know. The police don't necessarily know, right? But we're saying about 20%, only 20% is reported. And that's a guess. And so then sort of further subdividing that big unknown 80% otherwise, we just don't know. I don't think that it's the case that there isn't a problem of organized retail theft and that steps should be taken to try to combat it. California, however, put in $267 million at the state level for task forces around this. And it's hard to know with something. California's a big state. That's an awfully big number and hard to know whether it's scaled appropriately to the size of the problem.
Mm-hmm. So that will be something that you'll be interested in following up on and seeing if it actually worked to decrease shoplifting, right?
I think that's right. And with all these things that are going on right now with respect to changes in criminal justice laws and policies that are occurring in the wake of the pandemic and the increase and spike in homicide and other violence, as well as the drop and the rise in shoplifting and other thefts, there's a lot happening at the statutory level and at the street level with programs. And these are all very ripe opportunities for us to do evaluations and try to understand what's working and what's not.
Is shoplifting, we talk about this as a national problem, and some of the officials quoted in that column and were Chuck Grassley, the senator, and I know the House of Representatives has big hearings on this, but is it more a local problem? Different cities will have wildly disparate crime rates, and it's more dictated by the policies or the circumstances of different localities rather than what's ever going on nationally?
That's a great question, Mike. And cities have wildly different crime rates and homicide rates in particular. You'd be maybe surprised to know that, say, a place like Detroit has a much higher homicide rate than New York City, 10 times higher than New York City. And you could find examples and pairings of cities like that all across the country where you might be assuming one thing and the numbers would show something very different. And there are obviously myriad causes of crime and reasons why that might be the case. I think one of the most interesting things we're seeing about that right now was highlighted in the analysis by my colleague Ernesto Lopez in that last report we have out on crime trends through 2023. And what he did was pull out changes in the homicide rate in cities with high homicide rates versus cities that have had historically medium homicide rates and lower rates. And what he found was that the cities that had lower homicide rates spiked up higher and are coming down slower than the cities with high homicide rates. They didn't go up as much, those cities, and now they're coming back to pre-pandemic levels more quickly.
Right. So, okay, here's a clip from a podcast that I sometimes listen to called If Books Could Kill. And just to tell you and my audience, the tone of the podcast is very snarky. They're talking for an audience that they're preaching to the choir, essentially. And they're both funny guys. One is a background in law, one is a background in journalism, but they like to sort of explode myths. And the myth they were exploding here is the myth in the rise of shoplifting. And I'll just play you some of this. And I want to know, let's cut through the tone of what you're going to hear, but just the actual thrust of the critique, fair or unfair. Let's listen.
The weird thing about this whole like organized retail crime, shoplifting out of control narrative is that there's basically no real evidence that any of it is true.
Maybe this is happening, maybe it's not, but like there's huge bad faith actors at the very center of this, and they need to come with actual facts to us before we're gonna believe them. And until they do, the story is the retail lobby is trying to push a narrative for which there's no evidence.
We're partway through the most serious report in the business about organized retail crime, and it is nonsense.
Yeah.
In the report, they say, quote, "The lack of quality data has stymied efforts to raise public awareness about the scale and consequences of ORC.
No, it hasn't.
Well, first of all, that's one way of putting it, right?
Yeah.
Like, the lack of quality data is why you don't know the scale or consequences of organized retail crime. They're literally just working backwards from their conclusion that this is all really happening.
Okay, your thoughts.
Yeah, they're looking for some data. So let's return to the data here. As we said at the top of the show, it's a muddy picture. There are 24 cities that have consistently published shoplifting data over the past 5 years. That's not very many, but that's what's out there. And if you look over that period, 7 cities were up, 17 cities were down in terms of what was reported to the police. New York and LA had the biggest increases. St. Petersburg and St. Paul had the biggest decreases. We were also able to pull data on other aspects of the problem. We found that shoplifting is following the same pattern as other types of theft, except for auto theft, which has really spiked. We found that value of goods stolen per incident was up from $75 per incident in 2019 to $100 in 2021. That's the most recent year that data was available. We found that more than 95% of shoplifting incidents in 2019 through 2021 involved one or more people, and just 0.1% or 1 out of every 1,000 involved more than 6 people. So these mass events we've been seeing so much video of are very rare. And the proportion of reported shoplifting incidents that involved an assault or other crime rose about 9% over that time. It's still a very small share. It's less than 2% total involved in assault or some other crime, but it's up a little bit. So those are the numbers. And I understand at some level that many people are not going to have much sympathy for giant national corporations. But at the end of the day, this really hurts employees and it hurts communities that lose jobs and ready access to things that they need and ultimately pay higher prices.
And what about their critique? The numbers I appreciate. I always like the numbers. But what about their critique that goes beyond the numbers, which is that the retail groups or the lobbying groups are saying, we don't even know the extent, which is to say we're ignorant of the actual extent of the crime. And this, therefore, makes the problem even scarier. It is a bit of circular reasoning to use the absence of evidence as evidence that things must be much worse than we could even imagine, right?
Yeah, I think I'm saying from the outside analyst perspective here at CCJ, we have no connection to relationship affiliation with National Retail Federation or otherwise, that there's great uncertainty. I'm not sure that the retailers themselves have that much uncertainty. I think they have a much better idea of what's going on than the rest of us out in the public are aware. And I think they do have a much better perception of how much of that is shoplifting, things going out the front door, or retail theft, or organized retail theft versus that other type of shrinkage, which is employee theft or things that get lost and otherwise mistracked. And so, you know, what's tough and what I would hope we will see, I know that there are some folks in Congress trying to get more data out of the retailers for them to share that information with us. But it's rough going, and understandably, in some perspective from the retailers' part, they don't necessarily view that information as being something they want to share publicly. Right. So we're in a tough bind and trying to make policy, trying to help inform policy without anywhere near the level of data that we really need.
In your experience, do the retailers always clamor for enforcement and more laws or tougher laws? Or does that actually track with what you see about the empirical rise of shoplifting? In other words, we could maybe get a sense of what their internal metrics are showing by what they're actually advocating for in terms of public policy. Is that the case?
It's a really, really good question, Mike. And it does not track. So let's go back about 15 years or so when there was a wave of reforms that started happening in states under what was called the Justice Reinvestment Initiative. And that was a broad effort to try to right-size the nation's prison populations and bend the curve of incarceration down. And not all of the states, but about 35 states passed packages of reforms as part of that initiative and other efforts as well. And many of those legislative packages included changes to the felony theft threshold, the dollar amount that triggers a felony. And many states had established those thresholds back in the 80s, say at $500. And if you simply indexed those numbers for inflation, by the time you got to 2010, 2015, $500 in 1982 was worth something like $1,200 in the 2010s. And so a number of states were really simply catching up with inflation by the changes that they made. But throughout that initiative, retailers fought those increases in that threshold, and they fought them hard in states around the country. And that was during a period when there wasn't any particular evidence, let alone this type of coverage and concern about shoplifting. It was not a period where these numbers were on the rise. Property crime generally and larceny, of which shoplifting is a subset, had been on a long downward trend starting in the early 90s.
Adam Gelb is the president and CEO of the Council on Criminal Justice. He has a long history working for the states of Maryland and Georgia. He was once a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. I don't know, maybe bench presses 240 also, but it's an impressive resume. Adam, thank you so much. And thank you for your embrace of the ambiguity that is, and the ambivalence to some extent, and also the honesty of guiding us through what we know and what we don't know. Not everyone does that. So thank you.
Really appreciate the opportunity, Mike. Thanks for focusing on this.
And we'll be back right after this with Ben Austin and Johnny Veal. Johnny Veal was 17 years old when he and another man killed Sergeant James Severin and Anthony Rosato as they were walking across the Chicago public housing complex, Cabrini Green. This was the subject of Ben Austin's last book, High Risers, Cabrini Green and the Fate of American Public Housing. That character, the main character I mentioned, Johnny Veal, is not just a character. He's a real person. He goes by Khalif, and he is the subject, one of the two subjects of the more sweeping examination of the system of parole that Ben Austin has just written, Correction, Parole, Prison, and the Possibility of Change. Ben Austin joins me, as does Johnny Veal, who goes by Khalif. Hello, Ben. Hello, Khalif.
Hello.
Hey, thanks for having us on.
I appreciate it.
So as I mentioned, Ben, in that intro, you had written about Johnny, but never met or talked to Johnny. And this is a question that I know you've done some soul searching on, but why not?
The first thing I'm going to say is I'm going to correct something you said, that Johnny Veal was convicted of murdering two police officers in 1971, and the crime was in 1970, but it's a crime that he has always said he was innocent of. And so I just want to correct that. And yeah, so I wrote this book, my last book about this crime that happened in 1970 was part of writing about Cabrini Green. You know, it never crossed my mind once to interview this man. I didn't think that somebody who had been, you know, convicted in 1970 and sent to prison, I just didn't think about them 48 years later still sitting in a cell. And pretty much everything about our criminal justice system creates that disconnect, right? And all of our like rhetoric and values are about like sending people away, getting them off the street. They're gone. That was the soul searching I had. Someone reached out to me after that first book came out and said, hey, you know that guy Johnny Veal you wrote about? He's still in prison. He's innocent of the crime, and he's coming up for parole.
So, Khalif, when did you first hear the name Ben Austin?
Believe it or not, I never heard who he was, never even crossed my thought. A guy named Ted Pearson, one of my mentors from the Chicago Alliance, was in the battle with us trying to fight, you know, to obtain parole and whatnot. He mentioned him. He said, I ran across this book, and I had a chance to have a conversation with this guy, Ben Austin. Looking at some of the facts that we are trying to investigate, we think he got a good insight on the community and trying to locate some of the witnesses, you know, to collaborate and tell your story. And that was my first encounter acknowledgement of Mr. Ben Austin.
The book starts with a parole hearing that took place over Zoom, which to you, Khalif, was a technology you had never used. You weren't even, you had to figure out what it was like to do a meeting over Zoom, right?
Yes.
So how did you train yourself about what it would be like if your first exposure to this would be the meeting that would determine how many more years you'd be incarcerated?
When I started studying people on TMZ or just news interviews per se, body language played an important part of how people perceive you, how they gravitate towards your conversation or form an opinion. In my case, I had to control how people saw my body demeanor because an institutional posture is much different than a person that's in a few community with a posture speaking on the same subject matter. To me, I may be presenting myself, oh, I look good, or I did this great. But someone on the free community in the world looking at me by saying, oh, this guy is arrogant, or this guy is threatening, or this guy have this persona that I don't like. And it's like, how do I appease to the person or to the people who's going to view this video to pass judgment for my freedom? And I had to try to figure out, how do I present myself in an accepting way to modern society where I'm still a dinosaur, stuck in a non-electronic age.
Yeah, yeah. And Mike, if I can add to that,
yeah.
you're touching on something that is so critical, like the stakes couldn't be higher for this, what you called a performance. And imagine like having to speak over 15, 20, 30 minutes for your freedom. What can you say? The pressure that's on you, and also little things that might define you as, to their eyes, dangerous or criminal or not remorseful or not rehabilitated. Sort of like the almost default for a lot of board members is to see criminality. So yeah, Khalif is like the pressure on him and other people coming up for parole in these moments is immense. And yeah. And he had come up for parole dozens of times since 1980. And you have to get a majority of the board's votes, about 7 votes. It's usually about 14 people. He'd never gotten a single vote, even though everyone agreed that he was this amazing person in prison, that he was in his 60s. No threat to society. But he had been rejected every single time, not a single vote.
Well, let's zoom back. What are the stated criteria? What's the actual criteria if you want to cite any actual rates of granting parole? And what does a granted parole seem to correlate with?
Yeah, I mean, so there's like theory and practice. We call our prisons correctional institutions. We call the guards correctional officers. So the whole idea of prisons in the United States is that we're in the business of corrections. We're in the business of rehabilitation. And that's sort of, in theory, what parole boards are supposed to evaluate. What's happened to the person since the crime? What's happened to them in prison? How have they changed? Are they ready to be returned to society? All the other stuff about the crime was dealt with at trial. That's what a judge decides, or a jury. And so they're supposed to be looking at all this that has happened since. And in practice, they're still looking at the crime. And they end up repeating the work of a sentencing judge over and over and over again.
But in Johnny, Khalif, but well, since the state calls him Johnny, and that was his name in the minutes. So the parole board, and it must be very hard for someone who knows of his innocence not to do this, to state when the question is, why should you go free, not to immediately state, because I didn't do it. But even the board itself says that during the interview, and I'm sure that's true during past interviews where he didn't get a single vote, that he tried to litigate the case, quote, which is not the purpose or duty of the board. Okay, but what do you do about that? How do you learn not to use that as a mean, not to use that moment to say, primarily, I'm innocent?
It's walking a thin line, I know I can't relitigate the case. That is a given, because they're going to stand on the facts of 1970 from the state's attorney's office and the trial judge. My position at that time was, how do I convey my readiness for parole? How do I convey to the board that I'm acceptable risk? How do I convey with the board that I am not a 17-year-old kid, but a 69, 68-year-old senior citizen? What changes have I developed over the years? What my skill sets are? And most of all, my maturity. Here you is having a minor put in an adult situation as a 17-year-old, serving all his time in an adult system. My maturity and visions on life tells factors. They hold a volume of information of growth. Therefore, I have to point out what have I succeeded in, what have I achieved, what I have pursued and failed, just as well as overcame. You know, I have to point out all these factors that warranted that I be given an opportunity to show that I am ready for society, given the opportunity to show that I am not a 17-year-old kid, but I have matured greatly and understand the perils of society and what is expected of society of me.
Mm-hmm. What do you think it was in this last successful parole hearing that got through?
I think that my input, I have never given up. My faith, my hope kept me in the trenches, you know, of innovation, of doing things and trying to make a difference. Because each 3 years that I was set for parole, I had to reinvent myself. Therefore, I started creating programs for long-term offenders. I created a project called Project Sound Off and a legacy program where you can be, you know, involved in something, whereas if you was a long-term offender, whereas at one time, long-term offenders wasn't, you know, they weren't given the chance to attend school, take programs, or didn't participate in anything to further them along in education because it was a waste of time to contribute to any type of support for a long-term offender. The focus was on short-term offenders. So I started creating programs, being involved in mentorship programs. I had a mentorship program that I stayed in contact with for 10 years. I became a peer educator, teaching by human wellness, teaching HIV and AIDS, certified with the state of Illinois. And I just went on to my growth. You know, I did not let a defeat at the parole board stop me from growing as an individual.
So Khalif is presenting himself, Ben, Khalif is presenting himself very sympathetically. In the book, he comes across that way. You know, knowing what I know about him, if I was on the parole board, I might say, oh, this seems to be the kind of person who is saying all the right things. But shouldn't that be secondary or tertiary to the major determinant, which is that when people are 70 years old, and unless they have a long history of documented troubles inside the prison system, they are not going to offend again. And why is that pressed down so much or such a minor concern as you paint the picture of how parole boards really work?
Yeah. I mean, what you said is exactly right, that the age distribution of crime, whether you voted for Donald Trump or Joe Biden, people agree that the age distribution of crime, people commit crimes between the ages of about 17 and 26, the vast majority. And that people who are 55, 60 and older, their chances of committing another crime sort of statistically incredibly low. And people Khalif's age, it's nearly zero. So you could let everybody out. You could let him out and everybody out that age. And you're right. Like, we're not going to see any uptick in crime or very small. Why isn't that more of a determinant factor? Man, that's a great question. Like, you're talking to this guy, Khalif, and you're hearing these programs that he's done, the work inside. You don't have to believe me. He's telling you what he's doing. And he's also no risk to reoffend. And why aren't those more pressing?
Well, what do they say? I mean, the corrections, the field of corrections, just listen to the euphemism. They changed the name from prisons in, I think, 1954. But the field of corrections and the field of rehabilitation, I think there is some science to it, but they definitely have the veneer of science. Yeah. They have the veneer of, you know, statistics and evidence and something other than feel. But in practicality, will you tell me, is actual science being injected into the process more than it was 20 years ago?
But what they say, to answer the first question, is there are just some crimes I can't get over. Mm-hmm. There are just some crimes I can't get past, and this is one of them.
Because it was a policeman, or two policemen.
A policeman, yeah. Whatever it is. But you know, over and over again, I mean, this is in Khalif's case, but I've been to, you know, dozens and dozens of parole hearings as part of my reporting, And the vast majority of this is what happens, that the original crime comes up and it looms larger, it's more heavy. There are things that you said, like, what's the science? You know, they check things like, you know, algorithms about, you know, reoffending and risk rate and things like that. But in the end, it's much more conversational and like gut. And so then the decision of whether somebody gets out or not is often who is on the board. Do you have a higher percentage of like tough on crime people, former prosecutors, former judges, former police officers, or people who believe in, say, restorative justice or other things? And often just like a kind of whim, man. I mean, like something happens, you know, I'm a writer. And so when I went to a parole hearing for the first time, I was like blown away because it was a storytelling contest.
Yeah.
And with the story of the crime always way, way in the lead. But every now and then, like a story is told that, like, you know, changes things. It is pretty whimsical in that sense.
I know I've seen you do interviews and you talk about doing time versus time doing you. What's the difference? How do you make sure that the time's not doing you?
Well, when time is doing you, you're a nervous wreck. Your physical being changes, your health changes, everything goes downhill. There's no progress, there's no mobility in your life where you're moving forward. Everything is at a standstill. You really don't have a purpose in life. You're just stuck. And doing time means that I'm like, you have no vision toward the future. There's no focus on your goal setting. But whereas you doing time and gives you a better perspective on life. You are setting goals. You are finding out what you want to do, what you are dedicated to. What is your fight? Once you find out your purpose and what your fight is, you could pursue it. In my case, I was fighting for my freedom, my life, and trying to get home to a family that have dwindled as the decades went on. And so you have purpose. And when you have purpose, determination, and commitment, you focus on doing this time and how best serve you. I refuse to be a statistic behind the wall. I have refused to be someone who fall between the cracks. If you give up or not focus on what you want to do or how to do it and how to challenge those obstacles, you become useless.
So Khalif, you are, what is your status now? Do you have to wear an ankle monitor? Do you still have to check in? How long will that go on for?
I don't have to wear an ankle bracelet, that's for sure. That was the first 90 days. I'm supposed to have a mandatory supervised release date of 3 years. My parole time is supposed to be up next year, June.
Mm-hmm.
Now you look at my parole plans and my parole officer giving me the facts of the day. He's saying that I am due on parole for a lifetime, 2072.
Huh.
I'm like, let's recapture this again. Repeat that, please. He said, my records reflect from the parole board that you're on parole to 2072 and to the length of your sentence, which is a lifetime. And I said to myself, well, what about the law that applies to me, whereas I'm under the new law, dinosaur, grandfathered out, however you want to factor the case in. It was mandatory that I receive 3 years supervised release like every other inmate in the state of Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
So this is what I am fighting now. I am fighting retribution over freedom, retribution over rehabilitation, retribution over opportunity. How can I progress in life ever if a 70-year-old man constantly being referred to as, how we say, demonized? Just say I'm being demonized continuously.
Yeah. You were convicted to 100 years. Is that why it goes until 2072, according to him?
Yeah, according to him, yes.
Yeah, and the illogic of what we're trying to do, that we don't want somebody who's now out, who is corrected, to succeed. That we're limiting their ability to do the things that would help them succeed and be a productive citizen, to get certain jobs, to move around, to live a full life and contribute to our world. It's working against everything you think of in terms of corrections.
The name of the book is Correction, Parole, Prison, and the Possibility of Change. Its author is Ben Austin, and we've also been speaking with Johnny Veal, who goes by Khalif. Ben, thank you.
Of course, thank you.
And Khalif, thank you and good luck.
Thank you too.
And that's it for today's show. Corey Wara produces The Gist. Joel Patterson is the senior producer. You know them as the Quaint Mallards. I know Michelle Pesca as the director of special projects for Peachfish Productions. And just an event in New York City that is free to come to, Nancy Rommelman and I will be speaking at the Brotherhood Synagogue about, we both visited Israel at different times and we'll be sharing those reflections. You have to register for the event. I can't even put a link to it in the show page because they're very worried about security. They've gotten death threats in the past. Let's try to avoid that. So if you do come, please be nice to us. I'm sure you will. Go to brotherhoodsynagogue.org to find out more information. The Gist is presented in collaboration with Libsyn's AdvertiseCast. For advertising inquiries, go to advertisecast.com/thegist. Umpru, gpru, dupru, and thanks for listening.